Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 185, Science Faction, the Paleogene.
Are all the dinosaurs gone?
They are gone. We just lost them at the end of the Cretaceous in the last issue, except the avian dinosaurs that later became birds. Obviously, some of them survived. But we just had the mass extinction event of the dinosaurs that is marked in paleontology with the KT boundary.
With the extinction of the dinosaurs marks the beginning of your career in archaeology.
How dare you? First of all, no. Archaeology only studies humans. How dare you? The paleontologists, of course, study those dinosaurs. And this is a very interesting time in Earth's history. This is the time we've talked about a little bit. We hinted at it last week. Very, very interesting because this is the beginning of the age of mammals. Because of the extinction event that wiped out the dinosaurs, now these tiny little mammals that are scurrying about, they all of a sudden have a bunch of food. They survive pretty well through the whole thing. And now that there's all these open niches, they start through biological radiation to spread out and take over all of these different jobs that were earlier done by dinosaurs and reptiles and other animals.
Are we talking mammals or like marsupial mammals?
By the way, I like how you've distinguished mammals.
I don't count them. It's like, okay. I'm like an old school European racist. I don't consider Italians white.
And undoubtedly, there are marsupials around. There's still monotremes around, because we have monotremes around now, which are the egg-laying mammals. But we also have already diverged into placental mammals at this point as well. So we have all of those running around at this point, and different ones will kind of go out into different niches in isolated places, like we see in Australia. Before we get contact with placental mammals, marsupial mammals take over and do a bunch of different niches on their own. In fact, they evolve in what's called convergent evolution, where if you look at the thylacine, which is the Tasmanian wolf, it looks like a dog. It looks like a wolf that just happens to be a marsupial. It has some stripes on its back. It can open its jaw real wide, but it basically looks like a dog. It has no relation to the dog whatsoever. Its last common ancestor looked like a shrew, but it evolved into something that looked like a dog. And on the placental mammal line, something else evolved into something that looked like a dog through convergent evolution, where just because they filled the same niche, essentially, they basically developed almost the exact same body type. So to answer your question, even the marsupials kind of came and filled in almost the exact same roles that placental mammals filled in other places.
I mean, they're extinct now, but I heard that it was so difficult to tell the dog and the marsupial dog apart.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the only way to tell is if you saw the dog catching a frisbee versus a boomerang?
Yeah, that's right. They would only go for boomerangs, of course.
You wouldn't know what to do with the frisbee.
Very, very interesting. This is a huge period of biological radiation where we see kind of all the different living orders of mammals start to spread out now, where we can see things like what later became cetaceans, whales and dolphins and all that. And we see other marine mammals. And again, if you remember, animals first started in the water, then they came onto land, they developed into things like mammals, and in this case we see the emergence of those mammals back into the water to become things like whales, sea lions, otters, all those kind of things kind of went back to the sea. We also see the emergence of flying mammals like bats. We see big giant mammals, we see little tiny ones, we see scavengers, we see hunters, we see prey animals, we see all of this stuff, and it all kind of sprouts out because all of a sudden there's no dinosaurs around to take those niches anymore. We jump in, and eventually, as we'll see down the line, in the Miocene, we see a huge explosion of the ape group, which later leads to hominids and us. And so thanks to this whole event and this whole period in time, we are sitting here doing a podcast.
When does it lead to King Kong?
I think that's somewhere in the Miocene ape part, yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
That was a 43 million year period that went from 66 million years ago, as soon as that comet hit outside the Yucatan Peninsula, to the beginning of the Neogene period, 23 million years ago. And it's also the beginning of the Cenozoic era, which is a whole new era, because again, we've wiped out the dinosaurs. So we are now in the Cenozoic era, Damien.
You might as well have made up a word, which I believe you did.
And speaking of made-up words, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. With me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damien Mercado. Damien, how are you doing this afternoon?
Great. I thought you were going to call me your made-up co-host.
Well, I mean, made-up comedian, I guess. And, of course, our scientist for the evening, Connor. Connor, how are you doing?
Well, thanks. Ready for some good science?
Then I'd recommend Star Talk.
Yeah, you should go there.
Yeah, I really dragged this thing down.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, good show, yeah. And we, of course, are broadcasting this from the Madhouse Comedy Club along the skyline of beautiful downtown San Diego. Come on out to Madhouse to see the Saturday Night Showcase. And when you're not doing that, check out our website at www.thesciencefaction.com, where you'll not only see all the articles we cover here, as well as some we don't get to, but later on this week, shortly after the release of this podcast, we will be debuting the videos from the Flat Earth debate, the audio podcast of which was released last week on the Degenerates podcast. Damien, you were in the audience. You were running the soundboard for the Flat Earth debate. Anything you want to tease the audience with as to how the debate went as far in your eyes?
Yes, if you are going to listen to audio or watch video of this, I cannot stress this enough. Don't do it while driving, because listening to Bobby's opponent talk can be enraging.
It is an interesting debate. I'll tell you this. I studied a lot. Damien knows this. I studied like a month for this thing. I went really deep into their flat earth ideas. I really took it seriously because I wanted to present the scientific viewpoints as well as I possibly could. And I wanted to understand what they were saying as well as I could. There were some arguments he made that I simply was not prepared for. I thought I had prepared for all the flat earth arguments. But one of the ones I had not ever even heard before was, how do you explain the upside down buildings in Australia? Which... I couldn't.
To be fair, I mean, relative to us right now, somebody in the Southern Hemisphere is upside down.
That was his argument, and man, was I not prepared.
Yeah, because you can't argue with crazy. It was like a martial arts tournament, but he came in and like tried to pillow fight you. Right. Like
it was certainly an interesting one, so go ahead and check that out. Again, you can check out the audio of the entire debate at the Degenerates podcast. And if you want to wait, you can check out the video clips of it on our own website, www.thesciencefaction.com, on the video page.
Fans, when you listen to this, note how restrained and actually nice Bobby is. When you listen to anything his opponent Daniel says, imagine me saying that exact same thing, and imagine just how stupid and small he would make me feel. Rightly so.
Right.
So I'm saying is, you don't apply your justice evenly.
I will say this. One of the things that made the debate a little easier for me is the fact that we do this show. I essentially had been practicing with you this entire time for his insane arguments.
I was your insane sparring partner?
Yeah, basically. You mimicked his style perfectly. All right, guys. Now let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
All right. On to article number one. There's nothing humans won't bang.
True. I agree. Science.
You prove that over and over again with empirical research.
You won't let me babysit your dog anymore.
No, exactly true. Yes, indeed. We've talked before about different matings that happened within our hominid lineage, meaning that Homo sapien, our own species, we know they mated with other species of hominid throughout history. We talked about the mating with Neanderthals that happened in Eurasia. That gives us certain genes that all non-Africans carry along with them. And then furthermore, as they moved further east into Eurasia, they mated with another species we called the Denisovans, which is a relative, like a cousin species to Neanderthals. And they took more genes from them. And certain populations have more or less of these. But basically, all non-Africans have some of those genes from Neanderthals. Many non-Africans have even more genes from Denisovans. And we can see that those relations. We know that happened sometime after Homo sapien left Africa, let's say 70-some-odd thousand years ago. Now, to put that in perspective, the lineage that became Neanderthals and Denisovans broke off from the lineage that became Homo sapiens somewhere between 400,000 to maybe 600,000 years ago. So at the time, they had been separated by, you know, maybe as much as a 500,000 years in terms of genetic separation when they mated with those groups. We now have evidence, according to this new study, of a mating that actually happened in sub-Saharan Africa. This is a whole different group of Homo sapiens, happened in sub-Saharan Africa with a species 125,000 years ago, and this particular species was 1.5 to 2 million years separated from Homo sapiens at the time. So in this case, the species that they're banging is very different from themselves.
Is that why the result was a centaur?
It was not a centaur. It was us, because we still carry those in our genes. If you're sub-Saharan African, you still carry some of that within your genome. And it's very interesting, because if you want to think of like questionable matings, you know, at some point you have to go like, okay, so Neanderthals, they look like us, they have heavier brow ridges, slightly different body types, but they're still making tools, they're still doing all the same stuff we are. We're going back 1.5 to 2 million years ago. That would probably be Homo erectus or some species there that is a divergent of Homo erectus. We're talking about something that's got a much smaller brain capacity than us. So at some point, is it like going to the short bus and trying to pick up on the girls coming off of it?
They are legally citizens at 18 and able to make their own fucking decisions. I don't care what a conservator or fucking court says.
You're discriminating against them if you're not having sex with them.
Next, you're going to tell them you can't bang the elderly. Dementia be damned.
So that puts us in the same time period as Homo erectus, or do we know that it's them for sure? Or
no, it's some species that's a derivative of them, so we probably wouldn't recognize it as a Homo erectus. Now you also have to remember, you might say, well, what species was this exactly? We don't know for sure for a few reasons. This is an area that's tropical Africa, which means we have very low preservation. Tropical environments tend to have very poor bone preservation and fossilization, so we don't necessarily know what species this was. All we can say is, when was the last time this species that it mated with had a common ancestor with Homo sapiens, or the lineage that became Homo sapiens, and it goes back to 1.5 to 2 million years ago, which means it had to separate from the lineage that became Homo sapiens and Neanderthals and all the other ones back when it was Homo erectus. So we could, maybe this thing looks like a Homo erectus, maybe it doesn't, maybe it looks completely different from a Homo erectus, but seemingly, unless it had that convergent evolution we were talking about, where it also grew in intelligence substantially in the same way that the Homo sapien lineage did, seemingly, they were banging a pretty dumb hominid.
As attractive as I would find a Neanderthal, right. I would find that Neanderthal comparatively way more attractive than Neanderthal yes. Damien would find this ancient...
Absolutely, absolutely.
I mean, he'd still bang it, he just wouldn't tell anybody on a podcast about
it. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it would be like that time you went to the short bus.
Yeah, I really did. I talked about that.
So you might ask, well, how do we find this out? That's really old. If we don't have any fossils of these people, how do we know this? It's really interesting. This all came from a genetic study looking at a particular protein, the MUC7 protein, that codes for a certain thing in our saliva that helps promote a specific microbiome. So the researchers were looking at this broad protein throughout the human populations and noticing that sub-Saharan Africans had a markedly different one. And they were like, what is this? Doesn't make any sense. Why would they have this? Teasing out the genetic data, they realized this was an admixture from another hominid that was so ancient, it actually had a different one than we see in Denisovans and Neanderthals, because in fact, that split we're looking at is, again, 1.5 to 2 million years ago, as opposed to 600,000 years ago or 400,000 years ago. So they started looking at it and teasing out the genetic data and found out about this ancient admixture in sub-Saharan Africa. This is crazy to think about, because we've known for a while now that we've bred with other hominids. We knew that, like I said, with Neanderthals, with Denisovans, and by the way, in Eurasia, another mystery species that we can only tell from the DNA that we don't have any fossil records of. But all of that seemed very recent. All of that seemed like things that were very, very human-looking. I mean, you might not even know they were a different species if you looked at them. You just have a heavier brow ridge and thicker ribs and that kind of thing. But when it comes to breeding with like a Homo erectus, if this truly did look like a Homo erectus, you're going to know. Their brain case is going to be, I think, something like a third smaller than ours. It's basically halfway between a chimp's brain case and our brain case, if that puts it into perspective. So at some point, you almost start getting into a bestiality range.
The genitals just feel a little off.
Yeah.
And it's like hard to put your finger on exactly what's off, but like you're, after insertion, you're like, we're going to finish.
Does that curve left?
So was the key to solving this genetic puzzle, was it the mutation rate they relied on?
So that's a good question. When we find these differences, they can look at the different mutation rates to figure out how long ago it is. Now, keep in mind, we're doing two different mutation rates on two different things to figure it out. One is to figure out when the admixture happened. So how long ago in the human lineage did we breed with this species? Doing that work, you can work it back to about 125,000 years ago. Then, once you get to that, you're saying, okay, this is when the breeding was. Now, how far separated were the two individuals that bred? And then it's a whole different process. You have to reset that genetic clock and go back and figure out how differential those two were. So, yeah, they were looking. You look at a change mutation rate. You can look at the clocks as they tick. But you can also do comparisons because, again, we have soft tissue and genetic analysis from other species like Neanderthals and like Denisovans. We have mapped their genome. So because of that, we can look back and say, oh man, it's not even only divergent from us, it's divergent from them too.
Is it safe to assume that the mutation rate's going to stay constant?
Yeah, fairly so, yeah. And not just that, but you cross-reference them against a couple different things because you not only will have things like in this case, they wouldn't have a Y chromosome, but a lot of times when we're saying we're basing it against a Neanderthal or something like that, you can look at the Y chromosome change rate, which is completely independent of your nuclear DNA. Then you can look at the nuclear DNA change rate, which is completely independent of that. And then you can look at the mitochondrial DNA change rate. So that you have three different markers within your own genes, if you're a male, that will tell you three different change rates. And we can use those to all kind of approximate, okay, we got 100,000 on this one, 110,000 on this one, and 95,000 on this one. And so they kind of all match up to a similar time span. Now, on this, you wouldn't be able to tell Y chromosome, and you probably wouldn't even be able to do the mitochondrial DNA because you're not getting that directly taken down. But you would be able to tell how divergent that specific gene was, and in telling how divergent that gene was and when the last time we see that common ancestor having it, you kind of be able to figure out that change rate.
Okay, so there's enough checks and balances to where there's not something funny happening, like an induced mutation,
right,
whether it's camping on a uranium mine or aliens coming down and doing something.
Right, because again, we can kind of compare it to other hominid species that were around 500,000 years ago, not just us. We have a completely different thing to compare it against. It's always neat to me to see these intricate histories of hominid evolution. As somebody who grew up insanely interested in human evolution, like it consumed my interest. I wanted to go study it and did go study it in school and really wanted to know how human beings came to be. Back when I was first learning this, we didn't think, or at least the story that was being told was, we didn't interbreed with other hominids. We didn't interbreed with Neanderthals. That always seemed dumb to me. Even when I was an undergrad, that was still the idea. And it's always seemed silly because
I know friends who would bang anything.
Yes, exactly. I have always said these theories had to be propagated by women because as a man, I know other men, we will bang anything that looks like us. There is no way that doesn't happen. And it always seemed silly to me, and their arguments seemed silly. It was like, oh, we see Neanderthal bones and human bones, and there's nothing in between. And there's no kind of admixture. Once we started getting to genetics, we immediately found out that was wrong. We found out we bred with Neanderthals, found out we bred with Denisovans, found out we bred with these other things. This long, complicated history helped make us who we are today, and that's what's really interesting about it. The other thing that's interesting about it is something I'm waiting to happen, which has not happened to my knowledge yet.
To meet your Neanderthal princess.
No, yes. No, I think at some point we are going to see, if we ever get super educated racists, we are going to see this used as part of a multi-regionalist theory. So take a few steps back. The way we know human evolution happened, we all basically came out of East Africa about 200 to 300,000 years ago. We spread out. We did our own things. For a long time, people thought, oh, Irish people evolved in Ireland if they did think about evolution. We found out that's not true. We found out that, you know, Irish people are as African as everybody else. In fact, they spent most of their history in Africa. They only made it there 30,000 years ago. It's not that old. But what we're finding more and more with these admixtures, this is an argument that's been made by Chinese scientists in China. They say, we know we have these admixtures from Denisovans, from other species that are in China at the time. That makes us Chinese different from you guys. We actually have different genetics. We have different ancestors. We are inherently Chinese. In a way, we actually come from China because there are these other hominids that were here, living here for a long time. They interbred with us. And so we are genetically Chinese, not like you Africans. I almost wonder, when you get enough, like, if a Ku Klux Klan member takes a few genetics and human paleontology classes, if he comes out and he's like, that's why black people are so dumb. They mated with the wrong hominid species.
So, like, if David Duke were to, like, kidnap Bobby and, like, hold him ransom till he got Stockholm Syndrome and adopted a lot of his views.
Yeah, then all of a sudden I start spouting this off. I'm worried, but now, obviously, if for those of you who are thinking, oh, actually, that is kind of true. Okay, granted, there are some weird genetic admixtures that happen from different species into different regional groups. It is a tiny percentage of your overall DNA. It has nothing to do with intelligence, abilities, or anything else. It might confer to you, for instance, allergies or certain genetic immunities or that kind of thing. Other than that, it's not doing anything else, and it's totally dwarfed by the fact that we are a very young species with a common ancestry very, very recently in the past, and we are all incredibly closely genetically related. So if you look deeply into it, it's bullshit, but I'm still waiting for them to start using it as evidence for racist beliefs.
So we've had matings with Neanderthals and other,
right,
and which have provided advantages in,
right,
and as we just found, there you really can't name an advantage to this mouth microbiome.
No, you can. It changes the microbiome of your saliva, which would be dependent on the circumstance you're living in. So, for instance, maybe this species had a better microbiome for saliva for living in sub-Saharan Africa versus what we would have elsewhere.
Okay, well then there is something to be positive to be said about this banging of a disabled human. I'm using comparative.
The Paleolithic condom is half full to Damien, is what he's saying.
Yes.
I also feel like the clock's running out for the racists, because if we were getting admixtures 150,000 years ago,
right,
people had to walk across continents.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I mean, I feel like we're moving towards
a good
average genome pretty quickly.
Yeah, we're all going to be Rio de Janeiro soon.
Yeah.
All blended together. Yeah, and that confers a lot more genetic immunity. I mean, that's the thing you want. Technically, what you want is to mate with somebody who's from a very different place than you or whose ancestors are, because you add genetic diversity to a group. And genetic diversity is always going to give you better ability to handle vast circumstances, because you have two copies that are probably very different of each gene. That means that if something happens epigenetically, one gene might be able to take over the problem for the other. Or at least if you have a deleterious gene, you have something that's bad, you don't have two copies, which will usually, if you have a good copy and a bad copy, the good copy will kind of come through. That's the problem with inbreeding. Problem with inbreeding is, it's not like there's some magic thing that happens when a brother and a sister get together and magically the baby has a problem. The issue is that if you have a bad copy of a gene, your sister probably also has a bad copy of that gene. That baby inherits two bad copies and he doesn't have anything to make up for the bad copy, and therefore they end up having a problem. Whereas you're probably walking around with a whole bunch, probably hundreds of defective genes that are only made up for because you don't have two of those defective genes.
So if we could engineer a human with perfect genes, there'd be no problem with incest then.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's my Lannister argument, that's by the way.
That is why the old saying is, Jesus could have fucked his sister.
Yeah, that's the best argument for eugenics I've ever heard. Right. I want to create a world where we can bang our cousins or sisters, God have you.
I can't wait to see Damien on the campaign trail. All right, let's move right on to article number two, why certain people dogmatically believe they're right and how to change their mind. So this is an interesting topic that kind of coincides with our whole flat earth debate. Those of you who haven't heard the debate, let's just say Daniel, my opponent, was very sure that he was right, and that a lot of evidence that came to light that might suggest otherwise, it didn't seem to affect him like it would somebody who was...
sane.
I don't know, considering evidence. Yeah, sane. Yeah. And so what makes somebody dogmatic or not? And what even is dogmatic? So think of it from a religious perspective. There's a vast group of people who are religious. Most of them are not dogmatically religious, which means they don't hold that everything about that religion has to be true. And if they're presented with evidence to the contrary, the evidence is wrong, not the religion. The same thing can be said for anti-religious people. If I say to a religious dogmatist, hey, here is a problem I have with the Bible. Here are some inconsistencies here, here, and here. All of a sudden, they're going to counter and say, I'm the one wrong, or the inconsistencies are wrong, or the Bible's not false, blah, 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 blah. If I maybe talk to somebody who is, and I'm going to differentiate between atheist and anti-religious, if I talk to somebody who's anti-religious and say, hey, here are some good things that religion can do, whether or not it's true, and they then disagree, no, 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 you're taking these numbers out of context, that isn't true, blah, 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 they can be just as dogmatically anti-religious.
Ken Ham here, I don't want to agree. These anti-religious people are impossible to talk to. There's no reason. Ken Ham,
you hate dogmatism, right? Don't you, Ken Ham?
Not a fan of dogmatism. I simply follow the facts, and the facts all lead back to the Old Testament.
Just the Old Testament, though.
Yeah, the New Testament, I prefer a vengeful God. It's like the sequel. Sometimes the sequel isn't as good as the...
It's interesting. It's an interesting Ken Ham point of view.
Like, there's no, I'm just saying, if we had that Old Testament God, a lot of these anti-religious people would have been smorted by now in some sort of modern Sodom and Gomorrah or something.
So two studies examine the personality characteristics that drive dogmatism in the religious and the non-religious, and they show that both have similarities and important differences in what drives the dogmatism. So both groups, shocker here, both groups that espouse dogmatic views have lower levels of critical thinking and reasoning skills.
I think you're misreading the numbers, and okay, I think you're misinterpreting the facts that are happening there.
You're right, Ken. It must be those dogmatists that are doing this.
The problem isn't with the paper, it's with the person interpreting the numbers on the paper.
But the two groups diverge in how the moral concern influences their dogmatic thinking. So especially with those religious groups, it becomes a moral issue. It's right because it's moral. If the book is moral, then it has to be right. And if you're contradicting that book, then you are being amoral and therefore wrong. So morality and correctness go hand in hand in that viewpoint. That's not necessarily true of anti-religious people who don't necessarily feel that morality is associated with factual reality about our world. But you could imagine why, if you think a book contains the history of the world as told to you by a supreme being, it would have to be both moral and correct.
Again, I can acknowledge that the Old Testament God was not as moral, but I like that kind of strongman, which is why I'm pro-Trump.
And Putin. This suggests that religious individuals may cling to certain beliefs, especially those that seem at odds with analytical reasoning. You think of creationism, you think a lot of the clearly false beliefs, because those beliefs resonate with their moral sentiments. Yes, I can see all the science behind the arguments that biologists make about evolution. But if that were true, then God did not make us in his image, and therefore you are going against a moral belief that I have, which I hold stronger than that analytical belief. So if you look at those sentiments, the dogmatic person will always be able to put one of those scales of thinking forward. Because basically the way that neurologists have think about this is that people have two different brain networks, one for empathy and one for analytical reasoning. They are constantly in tension with each other, and we constantly switch back and forth between it. So their thought processes can go between the empathy and the analytical one, choosing the appropriate one for whatever situation they're in. And you could see why this would be important, because obviously you need analytical reasoning, right? We're a science podcast. It's very important. You need to be able to do scientific reasoning, analytical skills. That's how we get to the 21st century. That's how we have cell phones and cars and all the stuff we have right now. But at the same time, you also need empathy, and you need something that kind of goes over that analytical thinking, because if somebody were to say, I just lost a loved one, I'm so sad, my child just died on me. Now, the empathy part of that reasoning system will come up and say, oh my God, I'm so sorry. What can I do for you? How can I help? This must be the hardest thing you've ever gone through. I promise it will get better. If you were just thinking about it analytically and not being at all empathetic, you could say like, well, it's just a kid. You could have another. And you're probably pretty sad right now, just so you know, you'll never get over it. If you were just going straight analytical, you could do as much damage as going straight empathy.
I think you're making fun of a person with autism, because I think that's the far end of the spectrum. If the other end of the spectrum is like zealot,
right?
Like that autistic person's going to be able to get away with that.
Well, and it's funny because in a society, we live as social creatures. So both of these techniques are needed. If you were to think about us human beings being an individual lone creature, you'd only need that analytical thing. You wouldn't need the empathetic part. But by living in a society, we need to exchange ideas and live in the same world as other people around us and make relationships. And so that empathy becomes an important part of human beings able to socialize. And you brought up the autistic person. That's a great example. We have examples of people who have a lot of trouble with the empathy part and see how badly it affects their ability to fit into society. It becomes a big problem, almost as big as the people who are, or maybe even arguably bigger, than the people who have no analytic abilities and think the world was created 5,000 years ago and is flat.
Could you have someone approach it analytically and kind of shortcut the empathy by saying, oh, I know I need to appear empathetic,
yes,
but really they're not feeling anything, and the effect may be the same, but still in their head it's all analytical.
I actually think that's part of cognitive behavioral therapy that they use with people with empathetic issues, is they'll teach them, hey, just so you know, this is how humans think. You might want to try and do this. And what ends up happening is it's similar to the, assuming you don't have an underlying inability of your brain to process things, it's similar to the old trick that is used for customer service where they tell you to smile all the time. We've shown over and over again in studies, if you force somebody to smile all the time, they're forced to do it. It's for work. They're not doing it because they like it. Maybe that's even annoying to them because they have to constantly smile when their manager's around. It still makes them happier. Believe it or not, your brain responds in a feedback loop if you're constantly smiling, and you will rate yourself happier over and over again in many, many circumstances controlled for different variables, meaning that if you fake it till you make it, bro, you fake it till you make it. In some sense, we see that happening with cognitive behavioral therapy when you start teaching people, hey, I know you're used to thinking this way. Think this is how people normally think. You know, maybe you should, even though you don't feel curious, ask a question about that person at this point. That's going to change this. Eventually, what ends up happening is that person starts rating higher and higher in self-reported empathy because they're going through those motions, suggesting that there's some kind of feedback loop. Empathy isn't just something that springs out of your head and then you express. There's a feedback loop where as you go through certain motions, that empathy gets reinforced and strengthened and it goes back and forth. So yeah, to some extent, you can teach somebody that, and it could even help them further than just faking it. It could actually help them reach that goal.
I was quiet when Bobby advocated that autistic people should be cast out from society, but I will not be silent as you guys two are planning a curriculum to teach psychopaths to better hide among
<That's>
us.
<right. laughs> Well, and speaking of teaching people how to do things, it's interesting because this article starts talking about the interesting ways you can then try and talk to or change the mind of a dogmatic person. So yeah, on those extremes, if you wanted to appeal to a religious dogmatist sense of moral concern, then you can kind of start changing their mind. You don't necessarily want to start going right into the analytics. Here's how we know creationism isn't true. This, this, and this. You come at it from a moral standpoint, which could, and again, take your own choice on how you want to do this, but it could be, hey, well, just so you know, the one thing that makes me really worried about that is this whole evolution thing is really important for epidemiology and how we treat diseases. And then if we stop teaching kids this, we might not treat diseases as well, which means all these sick kids might have a really hard time. Now I'm not applying to the analytical portion of their brain of here's the evidence for evolution. I'm applying to the moral sense of let's save these kids.
Sounds like somebody doesn't have a lot of faith in the good book. Pray it away. Just like the gay, you have to pray that cancer away.
So, long story short, if you want to change somebody's mind, appeal to what they believe and tailor your message to the audience, not to yourself. It's one of the worst things that we do as communicators of science or education. We teach what we think would be most effective for us. You have to teach what the person who's learning is going to take in the best. And in the case of these type of moral zealots or moral dogmatists, you have to apply to the moral issue, not the analytical ones. If you're trying to reach an analytical person, you're not going to be able to do it through empathic moral reasoning. You're going to have to go through analytical reasoning. So teach and present to the audience with which you are dealing.
I can't speak for other countries, but I think I know a way that's slightly different than your way to teach an American dogmatic person that, let's say, creationism isn't real. Just tell them Obama believes in creationism.
That'd be a good way to do it, actually. All right, let's move right on to I Call BS.
I called.
I called.
I called.
I called.
I called.
Ring, ring.
I call BS.
All right, I call BS is the game where I read four science news articles, and my panelists compete to see which ones are real and which ones are BS, standing for bad science. Are you guys ready to play?
Yeah, I'm ready to hand Connor a win. How about you, Connor?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's see what happens.
If you're a new listener to Science Faction, go ahead and play along with us. And one of the advantages you'll get is you'll almost undoubtedly beat Damien, as he has literally never won a single game of I Call BS.
That's untrue. That's factually untrue.
All right. Speaking of factually untrue, let's hear Damien's answer for the first question. Article number one. A new study shows that drinking alcohol can help you remember things better. And the more you drink, the more you remember. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science. Because if it's true, then I wouldn't forget to wipe all the time.
Right. Yeah, and you would be better at this game. All right, and Connor.
I will go with science. You know, when you drink more, sometimes you're feeling a little bit more creative. And maybe this isn't talking about, you know, when you go out and have 10 drinks and blackout. Maybe this is talking about, you know, on average, if you drink two beers mm-hmm. a day, you know, maybe there's some hidden long-term effect there.
All right. Article number two. A new study details the functional curing of HIV from a child without long-term drug regimens or surgery. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is science, and I'm saying that even though I had a joke for bad science, but I actually want to prove you wrong and win for once.
Okay.
So I'm not going for the joke.
Oh,
I'm going to try and go for the win.
You go for jokes sometimes?
Occasionally.
Okay. And Connor.
I'll say science. There's a lot of exciting stuff happening in the biotechnology field, so I wouldn't be surprised if there had been a functional cure.
All right. Article number three. A new cancer treatment appears to restore hair color in gray-haired patients. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is science, and why I've bought a shit ton of stock in Rogaine's medical science division.
Rogaine, I think, just regrows your hair. I think you'd actually want to invest in Just for Men's cancer treatment division.
You're right. Your joke is far more accurate. I should have gone with that, but...
Yeah, well, maybe sometimes you try to make a joke. All right, and Connor.
I'll go with bad science. I mean, obviously, there are some cancer treatments that can cause hair loss. It seems to go in the opposite direction, but, you know, I'm just going to go with bad science on this one.
All right, and lastly, article number four, a new study indicates a steady increase in sperm count in men in Western countries over the last 40 years. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science. It's actually an increase in sperm in Westworld countries.
Oh, okay.
Those robots are producing sperm.
This is quite startling. This is basically that scene in Jurassic Park where they figure out they can mate.
Life found a way.
And Connor.
I'll go with bad science. Western countries typically have a lower fertility rate. We could see that being due to decreased sperm count, so... I'll say the opposite might be true, but yeah, I'll go bad science.
All right, let's go back and see how you guys did. Follow along at home and see how you did. Article number one, a new study shows that drinking alcohol can help you remember things better, and the more you drink, the more you remember. Damien thought this was false. Connor thought this was true, and this one is science. The only caveat is it's for learning done before the drinking began. So this is really interesting. It's been shown in lab settings before, but this study was the first to do it kind of like in a social setting. So they had 88 people come in, and they did a specific word learning task. They then split them into two groups, sent them home, and said, this one group, drink as much as you want when you go home. Just record and tell me. The other group, don't drink anything. Called them back the next day, and they tested them. The group that drank had better memory recall than the one that didn't. And even more interesting, because they recorded how much they drank and had varying amounts, the more alcohol they drank, the better they did on the test. There's a lot of ideas as to why this might be. And again, they have shown this before in lab settings. This is a one-off test. The only difference in this is they actually let them go home and drink in social settings as opposed to, okay, have some beers in a lab, and this could be different from a lot of lab circumstance. So this is more of a everyday type study. They think that alcohol blocks the learning of new information. So you're getting drunk, you're stopping the learning of new information, so you better remember what you learned before while you were sober. Essentially, there's less clouds of stuff in there because there's less insight coming in, less things to remember. You are turning off part of your brain for a certain amount of time and therefore strengthening what you remember from back when it was turned on.
No, I don't remember shitting on the table, but I tell you what I do remember. Physics.
Basically, it switches the hippocampus into such a mode where it's no longer making new memories. It's busy consolidating memories you already have from short term into long term. Very interesting study. Maybe it might not be such a bad idea to go study a little bit, do all your studying, and then go get shithoused. All right. Article number two. A new study details the functional curing of HIV from a child without long-term drug regimens or surgery. Both of you guys thought this one was science, and this one is science and fantastic news. So let's go over some of the cures of HIV we've talked about on this show before. Remember, HIV actually attacks your immune system. It doesn't usually kill you itself, but it wipes out your immune system, and then you're vulnerable to other diseases later on. So in taking out your immune system, the goal has always been, okay, how do we keep this virus from attacking the T cells and killing your immune system?
Gold chains on the T cells.
Pity the fool, I try and come in here.
So Mr. T cells, stay away.
So one cure, which they have done before, and we talked about a lot, is the Berlin patient, which is actually an American, but he was in Berlin at the time. Guy had HIV. He also had leukemia. They did a specific stem cell procedure where they essentially wiped out his entire immune system. They used radiation and chemo. They wiped out his entire immune system. Then they gave him these stem cells to restart his immune system. And the stem cells they chose were from a donor who is naturally immune to HIV, which is about 10% of the European population, but it is much lower in other populations. They're naturally immune to HIV. So they give him the stem cells for the immune system of this guy. Now his immune system essentially restarts as this guy's immune system in his own body. And much like this guy, who's naturally immune to HIV, the Berlin patient is now naturally immune to HIV. There are no more reservoirs in his body for his immune system because it's been completely wiped out, and his new cells can't be infected by that virus. So that was one cure, but it was very, very dangerous. Has a lot of downsides. The guy almost died. It's incredibly costly. There's a lot of things that go into the background of this. One of the other ideas has always been, if you give a child the treatment young enough who was born with HIV, you give them enough of the drugs, and then you allow the immune system to be able to adapt when it's very, very young to fight that virus in such a way that it won't later take over the body. That was the hope with somebody we call the Mississippi baby. They did this treatment on them where they gave them a whole bunch of antiretroviral drugs right after it was born. It knocked the virus out. Unfortunately, we found out years later the virus had come back. So that did not work. This is a similar instance. This happened back in 2007. This child was born.
Is it just me or is Mississippi baby seem like a slur?
It does sound like a slur.
For somebody like with fetal alcohol syndrome. Oh, just a Mississippi baby.
So this baby was treated back in 2007 as part of a trial and was randomly assigned 4 weeks of antiretroviral drugs along with 143 other babies. And once the treatment was completed, the virus remained undetectable in the child's bloodstream and has remained so ever since. So again, I didn't say no drug treatment. I said no consistent drug regimen. They gave this child a treatment for 40 days after it was born, and it seems like the child has no version of the virus still in its body. That's amazing news. It means that we might be able to cure, theoretically, a certain percentage of all the babies born with HIV, which in sub-Saharan Africa right now is a lot of the percentage of new HIV cases. So that is very interesting, very promising. I really hope this works out. We're going to see how the follow-up studies work on this because this could really change the game in HIV treatment in sub-Saharan Africa. Article number three, a new cancer treatment appears to restore hair color in gray-haired patients. Damien thinks this is true. Connor thinks this is false. And this one is science. The trial involved 52 people with lung cancer. They were given the drugs Keytruda, Opdivo, and Tecentriq. And the team researchers wanted to see if the cancer not only went into remission to some degree, but also to check if there were any side effects to this new treatment, this new combo of these three drugs.
Is it possible to have a version of the drug which would cure the cancer, but like make your hair grow in blue if you're more fashion forward or purple?
Sort of. So let me get into what happened. During the trial, one of the patients noticed their hair getting darker, which was like thought eventually. They're like, there's 14 of these people. It's probably just a one-off, a weird thing. Who knows? Maybe the reason his hair is gray has something to do with his cancer, and the fighting of the cancer turns out to be doing something for his hair. We don't know, but it seems like a one-off. Then the other 13 participants in the trial all of a sudden started to notice their hair getting darker too, going back to their natural brown or black from the grayed out hair. They still don't know why. What's even more interesting is the same drugs have been used in skin cancer trials in the past and were associated with your hair going gray. What seems to be interesting is there might be some kind of pathology here where because of they're going gray because of certain things going on in their body with cancer, and by stopping it, they're doing this. Also, the return of color or pigment to the hair is associated with the drug working well in these patients, meaning it's essentially an indicator of how well that drug is fighting the cancer.
What was interesting in the study is that one of the person whose hair came back black was a redhead before the study, and they're a huge fan of this drug now.
It'll be funny from now on when, like, old dudes start walking into the ER and just, I've got cancer, I swear. I got cancer. Give me the drugs, please. I got some cancer. And lastly, article number 4. A new study indicates a steady increase in sperm count in men in Western countries over the last 40 years. Both of you guys thought this was bad science, and this one is bad science. It is the opposite, making Connor our winner. Congratulations, Connor, for just continuing what I consider the stomping of Damien in every single time we play this game.
You've set up this completely unfair labyrinth, and I'm some lab mouse. Like, is this to see like how long I will take this abuse? Is this like the beginning of Ghostbusters? Do I get the shock every time?
I would love for you to stop taking the abuse and just like win the game for once. That would be great. If you just started winning the game, that would be fantastic for everybody involved.
I've called this podcast, especially this bit, a Milgram experiment, the longest running Milgram experiment. Every fucking listener to this podcast, all 10 of you, is a participant, and you're all monsters.
In fact, it is the opposite. A new study indicates not even a small 50% decline between 1973 and 2011, and it appears to be speeding up. They did this through a meta-regression looking at 185 studies between 1973 and 2011, and they found a 52.4% decline in sperm concentration and a 59.3% decline in total sperm count among men in North America, Europe, Australia, and New Zealand. Boom, that's crazy. Now again, they're not selecting these studies based on like sperm difficulties or anything. These are random sample studies. Seemingly, we shouldn't see anything different in this population than the rest of the general population in the Western world. But we know that it's not an overall drop. You can't be like, well, we blew up a bunch of nuclear bombs in the 50s and all this stuff's in the atmosphere and we're all getting screwed. Because the decline was not seen in South America, Asia, and Africa, though granted far fewer studies have been done, so it might be a sampling error. But basically, we're seeing that in Western nations, we're seeing a dramatic decrease in sperm count. That can be a lot of things. I think one of the ones that isn't talked about in this particular article, but that's a big deal, things like obesity. The bigger you get, the less your body focuses on gametes, the more you're likely to have sperm issues. That can be a problem. It can be a problem that we're seeing older and older men go in for these studies, whereas just selectively in other environments, you're not having 40 or 50-year-olds who are going in to get their sperm done or sperm taken. We might also be seeing something that's environmental pollutants. Maybe we're coming in contact with something that is affecting our sperm count. We know gametes can be affected much easier than other things. That's where you wear the lead apron every time you go to get x-rays.
Well, we also, I mean, used to be a lot more violent and patriarchal society. You know,
more testosterone.
Being the guy who didn't do good in school but was great at football, you could live your life just punching people who disagreed with you because nobody called the cops. Now that guy's a loser. Now people, unlike me, who did well in school and don't just punch their way out of situations.
Let me just say this, though. I would actually like it if this increased a lot more. I think our sperm count should be way lower. Like, it should be super hard to have a kid. One of the tragedies of modern human life is how easy it is to have a child, especially for dumb people. Think how many people get pregnant on accident. How great would the world be if nobody ever accidentally got pregnant? If you're like, man, I had to bang my wife 100 times without a condom under the right circumstances to finally have a kid. Our population would go way down. Our standard of living would go way up. our environmental impact would go way down. The world in general would be way better, way less overpopulated, way less dense, with way better results of better raised children, lower prison populations. Everything would be better.
I have a question for Connor. How possible would it be using CRISPR technology to make it so that the human genome, so basically we become more fertile. So that way in your 30s, there are a bunch of people I know in their 30s who are trying to have children now having difficulty. Whereas we don't want them to have kids in their 20s.
So he wants us to not be producing sperm until you're 25, so then you start going.
Like you peak around 40. Like that's when you can come in buckets.
Yeah, Connor, please let us know how realistic Damien's coming in buckets thesis might be.
Yeah, no, I think it's feasible. I was leaning more towards maybe a chemtrail scenario where we, do this epigenetically, but yeah.
I mean. Okay, so you heard it here. Chemtrails are a conspiracy.
All right, congratulations, Connor, for keeping up a proud science faction tradition of trouncing Damien in brutal, brutal fashion.
I have beaten Seb many, many times.
And thank you, audience, for coming back for Science Faction 185, where you learned about the paleo gene, why there's nothing that humans won't bang, why dogmatic people don't believe they're ever wrong, why the more you drink, the more you'll remember, how we might have found a functional cure for HIV, how cancer treatment might turn your gray hair back to black, and how there's been a steady decrease in sperm count over the last 40 years. Thank you so much, and come on back next week for Science Faction 186.
Or disagree with your statement that there's nothing human beings won't fuck? What are we, Catholic?
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.